Hello and welcome to Sci-Fi.
Sci-Fi?
Sci-Fi.
Yes, Sci-Fi, 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 a podcast where we both review and discuss science fiction, fantasy, or other audiobooks. So, what are we reading this week? Barry?
The Water Knife by Paolo Bacigalupi.
Excellent.
I don't think I butchered his name that badly.
Probably not. Better than me.
I'm sure he's heard worse.
And who narrated it?
Almarie Guerra.
All right. What did it say on the back of the book?
Back of the book says, in the American Southwest, Nevada, Arizona, and California skirmish for dwindling shares of the Colorado River. Into the fray steps Angel Velasquez, detective, legbreaker, and assassin, and spy. A Las Vegas water knife, Angel cuts water for his boss, Catherine Case, ensuring that her lush, luxurious arcology developments can bloom in the desert so the rich can stay wet while the poor get nothing but dust. When rumors of a game-changing water source surface in drought-ravaged Phoenix, Angel is sent to investigate. There he encounters Lucy Monroe, a hardened journalist with no love for Vegas and every reason to hate Angel, and Maria Villarosa, a young Texas refugee who survives by her wits and street smarts in a city that despises everything that she represents. With bodies piling up, bullets flying, and Phoenix teetering on collapse, it seems like California is making a power play to monopolize the life-giving flow of a river. For Angel, Lucy, and Maria, time is running out, and their only hope for survival rests in each other's hands. But when water is more valuable than gold, alliances shift like sand, and the only thing for certain is that someone will have to bleed if anyone hopes to drink.
Ooh, boy. All right. Kevin, what did you think?
You know, overall, I did like it, but there were a lot of unpleasant parts in the book. I mean, like the tone wasn't really the happy dystopia that I prefer. It was a little too realist.
It's a little too close to potential future.
Yeah, it is a wacky, distant science fiction scenario where the federal government is becoming gradually dysfunctional and we're all dying of drought.
Yes, that never would happen. Yeah, I mean, it's based on, you know, water rights and, you know, the different states and areas like kind of fighting for it. So there's a lot of state infighting and, you know, border guards. And so it's a bit past now, but it is a projectable speculative fiction.
Right. It's the science fiction version of Chinatown.
It's unpleasant, but there were some interesting parts.
Well, another rave review from Kevin.
Well, as from the same author, I've also read The Wind-Up Girl. I prefer that one, even though it's also unpleasant. It's unpleasant in a more science fiction way.
I think you've come up with some sort of new wrinkle on praising with faint damnation.
Yes. Oh, if you've never read one, I would say to read that one over this one.
If you've never read a book.
Yes. Those are words that come one after another and say stuff.
Okay, I'm feeling good about this. Yeah, I thought that this was extremely well written and most part enjoyable, but I had a hard time sort of getting through it just because I found it very plausible and very disturbing.
Right.
Most of the characters are very interesting. There are some decent, strong female characters and a lot of action going on. Some graphic scenes of different kinds, not for the younger folks, but overall, I found it, like I said, plausible and very chilling. So it may not be something you really love every second that you're reading it, but you should read it.
It's not a cozy catastrophe.
It's definitely not a cozy catastrophe. It's a dry dying of thirst, look, we're all in grinding poverty kind of catastrophe.
Yes.
Barry, what did you think?
I really liked the book. And like both you guys said, that it does seem a little more plausible than unplausible. So it's a bit more terrifying than most of the books we read.
I think in 2015, it would be the, oh yeah, that sort of ripped from today's headlines, this wacky science fiction scenario back when it was written. But
yeah, I mean, it is sort of like if you took the movie Chinatown and which is really, I think, about the Owens Valley water rights, mm-hmm. and pulled it into our near future a little bit, that this really could probably come true with all the corporate greed and
right.
state infighting and the federal government not really doing anything.
Yes. At time of recording, there was a brief earthquake, and I had this brief moment of, oh, maybe we won't have water problems at all. Maybe it'll just be, you know, massive earthquake problems.
Maybe they're connected.
Maybe.
Wasn't even a 5-0. Didn't get a bed for it.
Yeah, no. I think it was probably just everybody in Berkeley hiding their weed at the same time.
I am Mecca Trump. I am here for everything.
But it's legal now, they said. Yeah, I mean, there, especially up until, you know, a year ago, there we definitely had our drought here in California. And of course, it's not really over, but, you know, it's not as bad as it was, assuming we continue to get some more rain. We got like a little drizzle yesterday.
Exactly. Well, that'll cure the whole thing. No problems. Yes. Well, anyway, before we all die of thirst, I think it's probably time for us to move on to the discussion section, unless there was anything else. Nope. Okay. All right. Well, we shall return for We Are Sci-Fi.
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 And welcome back to our discussion section. All right. So I guess we can start out. Did we have any favorite scenes?
It's very difficult to pick a favorite scene from a lot of disturbing scenes.
Well, yeah. Let's see. Some of the most arresting scenes.
The hyenas?
There's the hyenas.
Oh, God, yeah.
Yeah, there's a vet who keeps hyenas and just uses them to play a most dangerous game with, I guess, prostitutes.
I was unclear
workers.
Whether he was actually a vet or they just called him a vet because he had the hyena.
Yeah, I wasn't clear on that either.
I think a number of things were left unsaid in the book. It sort of left it to your imagination to fill in those details. Yes. He was just called the vet.
Right. I mean, one scene that I kind of liked was Angels has been at least set up. They, you know, threaten the reporter's family. So she kind of is like, okay, I'll set this guy up just because he's not my family or whatever. And
right.
So he's waiting in the car and they swing by and just riddle it with bullets. And there's this whole scene where, you know, he's having visions of this assassin when he was a kid that killed his family or something like that, but let him go. And he kind of followed in the assassin's footsteps in a way, but he's sort of having these visions of the assassin kind of going, okay, just a little bit farther, you know, and kind of, you know, saving him in a sense, you know. And,
well, yeah, this book had sort of an odd kind of moral slant because the biggest differentiator seemed to be people that still had illusions and people whose, you know, had gone fully non-illusory, you know, as they said, you know, oh, she sees like me was, you know, her eyes are like mine, sort of saying, meaning that, oh, she's seeing the world as it actually is, as opposed to, you know, thinking that, oh, the water will come back someday. This will all be okay.
Yeah. We'll get rescued by the federal government or something.
I mean, usually in books, it's the person that, you know, kept the faith and, you know, said, don't worry, it'll all come back someday. You know, everything's going to be fine. That person usually gets some kind of reward at the end.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, there's no like strong heroes in this book.
No.
They're like all anti-heroes. And I mean, an Angel is probably the most heroic in a terrifying way.
Exactly.
The Sicario water knife.
Yeah, basically, you know, the guy that's there to sort of do the bidding of the Las Vegas leader, whatever name, Catherine Case. And
exactly.
And I had this odd kind of like, you know, because the big bad guy in most of the book was California, because California had like the senior water rights. And, you know, so some of the other places like Las Vegas had, you know, had their own water rights and they had enough because they were building these arcologies, which we can get to later. But I had this like very kind of disturbing, like, pleasure thinking, I guess I'm living in the right place.
Yeah.
California will
never
will make sure,
run out of water.
Yeah. Well, California will make sure its own continues to get water.
They even kind of pointed out that a lot of the Cali agents, as they called them, were, you know, very well dressed and well armed.
Right.
And it seems like a lot of the Arizona, Nevada were sort of a little bit more ragtag. I mean, they still had, you know, military gear and stuff like that, but they were far less professional apparently about it.
Yeah, it took me a while to realize that zoners meant Arizona residents or something like that. Oh,
I don't think I ever quite realized that.
Well, I read it when I saw Barry doing the document, so I figured it must be right.
Well, there's a lot of classifications of people that gets thrown around that isn't, you know, explained in depth. I think. Like the fivers turned out to be people who actually have 5-digit addresses, because those are the people who live in the arcologies.
Ah.
I mean, there's a very brief mention of it in there.
But yeah, there's like one line where it's
thought it had to be something like that, but I wasn't sure. You know. Yeah. So my favorite scene, ironically, is also, you know, the scene where I was just like, wow, we have gone through the moral event horizon. And it's the ending of the book, actually.
Yeah.
Where it's the big heroic moment. You know, they've gotten a hold of these senior water rights, senior to God, I think is what they kept on saying.
Right. They're essentially the first water rights that were put down on paper, and
exactly.
Nothing could possibly precede them.
And so Lucy Monroe, our heroic reporter, gets the hold of them. She says, I'm sorry, guys. You know, I know you all want to sell them to the highest bidder, but I am going to take these and I'm going to give them to the city that is out there sort of dying of thirst. And right. I am going to save this city. And
you know, the imagery there is that, you know, it's the city of Phoenix, right? So it's going to, you know, re-rise out of,
right.
Exactly.
Out of the
and
dust.
It's just Phoenix, like, hashtag Phoenix rising.
Then, and her lover can't bear to pull the trigger. And then the young woman that had been sort of just trying to survive and run across the river with them just shoots her.
Yeah. She's like, yeah, but what? Where are you going? Those were my rights.
Yeah,
like,
exactly. Where are you going? Bang. No.
Right. And her, you know, Angel, her quasi-boyfriend was kind of like, I feel a little bit bad, but you'll be okay. Let's go back and exactly. take these rights back to my boss.
It's like, it's a very quick mental calculus. He's like, well, a little uncomfortable about what just happened, but we're going to roll with it. And I'm going to get back into Catherine Case's good graces. And
I mean, it was for everybody there, that was the right pragmatic decision. And from his perspective, she had mostly just suffered from this bout of temporary insanity.
Yes.
And I think that, like, I read an interview with the author, whose name I'm not going to really try without any practice.
Paolo.
Yes, with Paolo, saying, you know, sort of the difference between Las Vegas and Phoenix was that Phoenix sort of relied on idealism, where mm-hmm. Las Vegas, you know, got out the water knives.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, the beginning of the book is basically they get this, like, temporary injunction to, like, and say, okay, these are our rights, mm-hmm. and so stop using them. And they knew it would be overturned, like, the next morning when the courts opened.
Right.
And so they said, you have 12 hours to basically slaughter everybody there and cut off their water rights and blow up their filtration plant, you know, which they did.
Exactly. And our main character, well, so in the book it is pronounced Angel, as, you know, Kevin, you point out that was giving you Buffy flashbacks.
Yeah, I kept imagining Angel, and then I'm like, that's not working, you know. But, you know, because that's like the strongest, you know, mental tie I have in association to that name.
It's somebody's like, gonna drink, somebody's gotta bleed.
Yes.
But, okay, this was just a very minor thing that I just found really bewildering. So Angel is Hispanic, and he actually corrects Lucy's pronunciation. She tries to call him Angel, and he says, no, it's Angel. But throughout the entire book, not just from Lucy's perspective, throughout the entire book, the narrator, who is Hispanic, and so I believe knows better, calls him Angel.
Yeah, I was trying to determine if they were using the Americanized pronunciation during sort of internal narration versus external narration, you know, as a thought process.
I guess, yeah.
I couldn't keep track.
Well, they really only said Angel once, as far as I could tell.
Yeah, I think there was one. Yeah, you know, I think you're right. It was only
Lucy
this one time in the whole book.
Introduced to him. Well, theoretically, he should have said, I'm Angel. And she replies, Angel? And he says, no, Angel. Which, as I was saying earlier, it's just like, if I went up to somebody and I said, you know, well, my name's Steven, and they said Stephen, and I'm just like, no, it's what I just said. And how do you know how it's spelled?
I didn't transmit it to your brain as the spelling.
It doesn't make any sense.
Right, and Batman's from Gotham.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, it's a very minor point, and I'm not really criticizing it. I just don't know exactly how that happened.
I suspect it was just a directorial decision that just said,
I guess,
most people, yeah, for this audience would assume this pronunciation or something. I don't know. Mm-hmm. It's unimportant.
I'm confused and I don't know what to think.
Exactly.
I don't think I had any favorite scenes. I mean, this is basically a book of a series of scenes that I might be able to pick a favorite if I listened to this a couple more times, but a lot of them were just very gripping. Like the whole book was very engaging.
So the one thing that I thought was, well, the one big part of the reason this book was picked, right, was because it had Arcologies in it, right?
This is one of the books I put on the reading list because it did have Arcologies in it as opposed to Arkwright, which had none.
Yes.
Which I still don't understand how it got on the list for that reason.
I think they misunderstood Spaceship as an Arcology or something. I don't know.
The internet has wronged me.
Yeah. I think that they just took the word arc
and assumed Arcology.
And assumed Arcology.
Yeah, this is the first, well, I don't remember. I'm trying to remember if I read any of the books that explicitly talk about making, you know, a self-sustaining building, you know, and it's not like 100% sealed like a space station, right? You know, mm-hmm. It doesn't have to be. They have a small water input and they reuse 95% of it or something like that. So.
Sure.
But they did go through, you know, kind of this, you know, enclosed permaculture like description of like, well, there's like algae and there's fish and there's this and that. And so there's these big systems that they've done a lot of, you know, calculations and they pretty much work. And they kind of also talk about how they have these, what do they call them? Johnny trucks that like drive around the city so that people don't like just crap in the streets to, you know, spread more disease and stuff. And right. They basically are like, ha ha ha. They're supposedly doing you a favor, but they're really going around to try to collect more like biomatter for their stuff.
Right. I think it's the Chinese corporation Taiyang that basically sponsors the Johnny trucks because they could eventually profit by, you know, processing all the waste for people who live outside the Arcology because
right.
They could decompose it into, you know, the water. I mean, even they have like, what do they call them? The quick bags or?
Right. The still suits.
We should
suits.
Really talk about this a lot.
the not still suits, but they did mention eventually they'll have a still suit, which they didn't call it that. But yes, basically the drinking bags where you just piss into the bag and then you could filter that right back out. And, you know, of course those are basically for the homeless Phoenixers that live in the street.
I mean, they literally have scenes where people will pee into the bag and then they immediately squirt, you know, the purified, you know, water back into their mouths, which is a little weird and terrifying. And
let's discuss this so much more.
Maybe one of the reasons why I like this book so much.
Indeed.
So the MacGuffin, the water rights, that was something that I thought was a little bit odd in such a cynical universe. Would somebody just coming up and say, I have a piece of paper that says that I have these old water rights. Is that actually going to work? I mean,
well, right. I mean, I guess if they are able to validate the authenticity of the document and say, okay, yes, these are senior water rights, you know, in the book, you know, as reparations to some local tribe, they've sold, you know, this massive amount of, you know, water rights from this river or something to this Native American tribe, right? And then the tribe turns right around and sells it to Phoenix and moves to a place that actually has water, like right. Up in Canada or northern somewhere.
Well, I think the missing element that goes in part of this deal is that you have the water rights and then you find someone who's, you know, some percentage of, you know, of that, you know, genetic makeup of that tribe. You know, they're a descendant of the tribe in some way. And you basically pay them to be the proxy.
Well, I thought that in the book they said that they had actually sold the water rights to Phoenix, and Phoenix technically owned these rights, but they didn't. This sort of like they only like cursorily read them because they were so old that they didn't quite realize they had these rights. That they basically they said if you read closely, because the guy was wasn't he one of the Nevada people or whatever? And I think it was from Catherine Case's.
Yeah, I don't recall that part.
Anyway,
yeah.
Like they said, there was a part where they were saying he was one of these people that, you know, was out of favor. So they send him to some backwater reservation where he's going through these old paper files and stuff and kind of like as like a punishment.
But James Sanderson?
I think so. But as, you know, among his punishment, he's like going through reading stuff and he finds these like rights that are like, you know, better than anything that exists. And so he's like, haha, well, I'm going to cash in myself since you're screwing me over anyway.
Yeah. I mean, maybe I just misunderstood, you know, the water rights mechanism, but maybe it is more like a bearer bond and whoever just has it.
Yeah. That's the part that kind of confused me because I was like, well, if it says that Phoenix owns these, if they come to light, wouldn't they just say, oh, we own that? What are you doing? You know, it doesn't matter if you have this piece of paper, but like you said, maybe if they're just like a bearer bond, then whoever actually has the piece of paper owns the rights or something.
Well, which apparently like bearer bonds haven't been issued since the 80s for this very reason.
Yeah. But I think, you know, you wouldn't necessarily have the rights to the water, but you could pop up and sell it to, you know, basically there's there are plenty of people that would pay to see it destroyed as well.
Well, that's kind of what I was wondering is were they kind of, because, you know, the Las Vegas, Catherine Case, you know, Nevada contingent, they're kind of like, you know, anti-California, but they also, she's willing to sort of climb into bed with California in order to maintain their rights too. So she's like, well, they're the next biggest player. They're the ones who would, you know, really want to see this go away. So she, like towards the end of the book, she makes a deal with them basically saying, hey, you know, let's not like either tell anybody about it or we'll share the rights. It's a little unclear, but
I mean, it could also be that you go back to Phoenix and you say, look, you guys have these water rights, but you don't have any proof of it. I mean, it'd be a shame if, you know, the document were to disappear. And so why don't you give me some of this other water? And then, you know, you'll get the documents back. It's sort of like maybe a blackmail thing or.
Yeah, it sounded like, I think the most plausible was either the bear owns the rights or they just disappear. There's, you know, we're just guaranteeing that they're never going to pop up again and we won't tell anybody about them.
I'm just changing my name to the City of Phoenix.
Exactly.
It's not the bear who owns the rights.
My name isn't Prince. It's the City of Phoenix and I own these rights.
All right. Let's see. Yeah, so was this a worst case or a best case scenario, I guess, is one question.
Well, living in California, it was awesome.
I'm calling it a best case, you know, world scenario. Well, some people might argue that it's a worst case. I'm sure it can get a lot worse.
It's one of those situations where water is one of these resources that literally falls from the sky, is endlessly renewable, and yet is completely scarce. It's, you know.
Well, right. I mean, I think they didn't go into a lot of detail, but I don't know if that book they mentioned was supposed to be a real book or not.
It's a real book. It's actually what this whole thing was based on.
Okay. So maybe you could discuss that if you know anything about it, but
I just did.
Okay. Well, now that you have talked about your in-depth knowledge.
Books are made of paper.
Yes. Yes. They mentioned this book that's basically like, you know, the implication is, you know, we built this stuff in the desert and one day the water's going to go away and we're just pretending it's never going to go away. And then they proceed to essentially like drain the aquifers with like, you know, completely inefficient agriculture.
Right.
And
well, that's sort of what we've done with our, you know, the California Central Valley.
Right.
There's sort of that, almonds, damn it.
But I mean, there's a marker out there that sort of shows how much the Central Valley floor has sunk because we've pumped so much water out of the ground.
Right.
You know, it's something like 70 feet over the last, you know, 60 year or 80 years.
That's kind of terrifying.
Yeah. It's like, and they keep having to add to the pole to make it work.
So that's
I'm not concerned. It's the commons. So why would anybody destroy it?
Yes. It's,
but I like rice that's grown in a desert.
Yeah. It's the kind of stuff that it's sort of like with, you know, renewable energy or anything where you're like, okay, we have at least some technology now. I mean, I'm not saying we could necessarily build an arcology, but I think we could do a pretty good job, or at least, you know, thousands of percent better than the average building is now, right?
Sure.
And, you know, you read about things which may be worst case where they talk about like in agriculture where they've sent in people to look at like, you know, these big plants or something. And it's like, oh, look, this valve has been open for 20 years, is pouring under the ground and nobody ever noticed. It's like sealed. It's like rusted open or something like that. Because, right. You know, we get so much water. It doesn't matter if we're draining, you know, thousands of gallons out, but you know, that's nothing compared to how much is used. And so it's sort of, you know, you can see bad things are probably going to happen somewhere. Meaning, you know, actual droughts, maybe as bad as in this book.
Sure.
I mean, on the same vein, there's even the case where people now are starting to look at, you know, the fact that we have these open waterways that move water from, you know, Northern California to Southern California. And a lot of, there's a fair amount of evaporation that occurs because right. It's being transported out in the open. Yeah. And people are looking at ways to cover the aqueducts. And
right.
It turns out that, you know, one of the ones I read about recently was, well, actually, if you just fill it full of, you know, white ping pong balls, mm-hmm. which just reflects a lot of the heat, it turns out you could drop the evaporation rate down to like 1% of what it is right now.
Right.
Sounds like it's time to buy stock in white ping pong ball companies.
My name's Forrest, Forrest Gump, and I like playing ping pong.
Okay, so we have now achieved the milestone of, I believe, our first Forrest Gump impression on the podcast.
Mama Check. Always said.
Achievement unlocked.
All downhill from here.
Well, so then, of course, you think, okay, something that it never occurred to me when I was watching Star Wars is what a moisture farm actually was when I was a kid. It was just sort of like, I don't know, they're moisture farms. But, you know, later on you kind of realize, oh, what does that word actually mean? Like, you know, and I think, didn't they say someone had recently come up with some technology that would do that? Like some guy in San Francisco or something was just, you know.
Okay, possibly.
I sort of vaguely remember an article recently about that, yeah.
Yeah, like in the last year or something. Like, I don't know. It wasn't like a major thing, but it was sort of like, hey, someone's actually invented the moisture farm. And so, you know, you're kind of thinking, you know, there has to be, you know, some kind of technology along there. You know, desalination technology, I imagine, would be a major one, but it's
just watch out for those droids with the bad motivator units.
Exactly.
Uncle Owen.
Look, they're desiccated now.
Yeah, I always assumed that the moisture farms were trying to just, you know, condense moisture out of the air.
Well, I think that's what it is.
Okay. Sure.
I mean, you could essentially do the same thing with a, you know, a plastic tarp and
right
a stick, I think.
And dig a hole in the ground.
Yeah, or you could use a pot.
I've done that before. It was cool.
You stole water from the air.
Did you have the rights to that water?
Yeah. It was on my parents' property, so probably yes.
That does not necessarily mean you had rights to that.
Well, they had a well on the property, so probably.
Oh, so they did have water rights for their property.
Yes.
You know, you go towards like the Midwest and, you know, people don't actually have, you know, mineral rights or oil rights for.
Well, that's true of this area too.
Okay, well, this is exciting. So
but
our usual questions.
Relevant.
Quite relevant.
Why is there an oil derrick in my backyard now?
All right. So was there tea? This is a book that is light years away from tea. It's sort of like the entire book is about a lack of tea.
And if you had enough water to make tea, why would you waste the water?
Exactly. You just drink it.
Right. It seems like maybe one of the rich people might have been drinking tea, but I really don't remember that happening.
Right. I know. I think we would remember.
In some sort of weird way, I'm sure the urine recycling bags is sort of like a human tea.
I am going to ignore that.
And yet you've thought about it again.
I think that would be a tisane, wouldn't it?
What character would you want to be and or who would you be? In California.
Yes, we're already there.
I would be a fiver.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's not a whole lot of, you know, things that are really attractive in this book. Has to be.
You could have ideals, but that seems like a terrible idea in this book. The moral of this book is don't have ideals.
Or you can be the guy that had the water rights. And if you were that guy and weren't totally greedy, it might have worked.
I mean, we assume that Angel or Angel makes it to his destination and, you know, his boss gives him his life back. But, you know. It seemed like it was like the paper equivalent of the Ring of Doom. Just everybody who gets it is just like, oh, yeah, humdy dum, I'll do the right thing. No, I shall rule the world now.
You're right. I didn't really think of it in that context, but it basically, like, they're instantly corrupted by the rights.
Water rights is the one ring.
Yeah, exactly.
But the minds of men are easily corrupted. Or the hearts of men, whatever.
But the waters of men.
I mean, if I had to pick somebody, I absolutely had to pick somebody to be in this book, despite being, you know, all shot to hell, I think I might be Angel.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, seems like he's going to come out the best on the backside of this with his boss and
titular water knife. Took me a while to sort of realize, oh, it just, you know, it that's just referring to him.
Yeah.
Yeah. And like we were saying before, I think he was kind of the most sympathetic character, in, you know, in spite of the fact that he went around just assassinating people without even thinking twice about it. It's sort of like, well,
that's why Barry wants to be him. You see, we've already determined certain things.
It's just business. It's not personal.
Yes. The most disturbing parts of the book really are it was littered with realism. So it's like, there was just a lot of like, oh, you're trying to peddle water here and make like 20 cents. You haven't paid your cut. Right. And then like, you know, there's a whole subplot where, you know, she got some accidental cheap price on the water, but, you know, her friends basically.
Well, it wasn't an accident, right? I mean,
someone was messing with the markets, right?
She was doing insider water trading.
But she happened to be there when it happened. I don't think
sure.
she. Well, she had
wasn't was entirely accidental. She was there
to see if it was true.
Yeah, and then she's just like, "Oh wait, it I can make true. Money off of this." But the problem was that she still had residual idealism. She thought, "Oh, I can just go here and make money, and it's my money, and I already paid the tax on it."
Yeah,
and not realizing, "Oh no, if I don't hide the fact that I'm selling."
Right. There were several times during that you're going, "What are you doing? That is really stupid." And then they kind of had her internal monologue going, "Oh God, that was really stupid." And then, you know, she ends up almost getting killed. And
yes,
there is some very definite, palpable fear in this book.
Oh yeah.
Right. I mean, the fact that the water station that she's at is sort of like this, you know, Red Cross, Tai Young, you know, public water pump. Right. And there's essentially a big LCD display on it that sort of shows the current price per, you know, quart or whatever it is, right? And so when she goes out there to see if what she's been told is true about the price dropping at a certain time when, you know, one of the arcologies is pumping water back into something or, you know, whatever the reason was, you know, she's out there and it's like I found it actually very disconcerting that there may be 100 people lined up, you know, for this thing, and everybody's just trying to like get a little bit of water, and they have to pay, you know, amount of money. Whereas, like, you know, today right now, it's like you just get a bill at the end of the month. And you're like, okay, this is how many units of water I used,
mm-hmm. right? And they had this whole thing too, where like it used to be you can put in like dollar bills and stuff into it, or like, you know, $20 bills, and you can just, you know, you've locked in your price. But then they realized people were trying to actually, you know, buy at the low prices. So they started only accepting coins or something.
They talked about, in Las Vegas, there are these fountains on the street and you can just go get water from them.
Right.
They're talking essentially about water fountains.
About the Bellagio. And
yeah, exactly.
Right. And yeah.
Which is kind of excessive even in this day and age, right?
Well, and
it is. A lot of fountains in a lot of areas are just dry now. I mean, yeah. Like, you know, there's this fountain in Las Casas by the library, and that one has been dry for years as far as I know.
Yeah. I mean, even here in Mountain View, the fountain they have in front of City Hall hasn't run in, I think, 5 years or something like that. And one of the things they learned recently was that it no longer works and is going to require a significant amount of money to repair, because if you don't run the fountains,
right,
it like corrodes away or something.
They actually end up destroying themselves. So they're trying to figure out what to do.
Yeah.
I suggested putting plants in it.
It's one of those things where, I mean, I kind of wonder where this idea of, we'll just spray water up in the air down, you know, in the middle of the city. I mean, did that come from like Roman fountains, which were really more about like having the equivalent of a drinking fountain in the middle of the city, so you didn't have to.
Right, it was an actual public benefit.
Right, exactly. Whereas I think that it just gradually got further and further from that, whereas now you would never want to drink any of the water ever associated with that.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I assume
especially
it's
with all filthy money in it.
You know, I mean, I assume it's just for decoration, you know, for quite a long time. But when you have water droughts and stuff like that, you're like, okay, well, this is kind of excessive that we're burning off this much water. And it's hard to, you know, justify it when you're trying to balance a budget. And
yeah,
like, it's pretty. So what if we're burning away like all this, you know, whatever.
I'm starting to feel more sympathy for Rey from The Force Awakens.
Yes. It's, I don't know. It's like, this was, I mean, like we were saying, I think it's a good book, but it's very chilling and there's a lot of, you know, the different gangs controlling different areas and violence and stuff like that, that made it less speculative feeling and more just disturbing.
Yeah.
You know, and it's, some parts of that overshadowed kind of the concepts, you know. I mean, I think
I'm just imagining, you know, all of the dystopian novels that we've read probably also had their equivalent of our podcast.
Probably.
They're just like, you know, I don't really like this dystopian novel that we're reading this week because it's too much like real life. I mean, their zombies are a little bit faster than ours, but aside from that.
I think the realism of this book actually made it more enjoyable for me. I mean, in a
that's because you're a monster.
Well, yeah.
Well, I mean, I think it made it more blunt and like, yes, this is actually what would happen. You know, obviously, you know, pretty much no dystopias or something that you really want, but many books make it, you know, like the Cozy Catastrophes, you know, it's like, hey, it'd be, you know, back to nature and it'd be great, you know?
Right.
And a lot of ones that are still really horrible, are there's a lot more fantasy in it, and this is just a lot more like, it's like you're watching Vice in like about 10 years, and you're just like, God, I'm just going to kill myself watching the news. It's just like, it's just disturbing. Like,
in this particular case, you know, Mother Nature is basically trying to kill us. Mm-hmm. You know, mostly through our own actions,
right? And so it's a very realistic and it's a good book, but I guess my point I was trying to say was that the gritty realism of the day-to-day, you know, survival, kind of overshadows some of the overall concepts of like, oh, you know, you should pay attention to water. Right. It's like, you know, and is that was just my opinion, you know,
but also I think there's a recurring theme of, you should pay attention to the world. You should pay attention to data. You shouldn't just have your ideals and assume that everything's going to work out okay, because those people just wind up in dead or looking very stupid or both.
But if global warming was true, why isn't it super hot here as opposed to super cold?
Yeah.
Hashtag Phoenix down the tubes.
Exactly. Hashtag America down the tubes.
Earth down the tubes.
Earth, I think, down was the tubes. The, yeah.
Yep. Fall into the gravity well. Yay.
Well, I think that there's, of course, yet another knock at the door, and we're,
Sicarios are here.
They're looking for the gel inside our eyes.
Grab the papers and run.
Exactly. So until next time, or until we die of thirst, we have been sci-fi.
Sci-fi.
Sci-fi.